After dressing appropriately, Kyla walked to Logan's tent. The tent was dark, and lanterns were needed to illuminate the maps that the officers, Agon, and Logan were studying. Kyla joined the group. The maps were accurate, aside from missing the supply train.
They outnumber us 6-1, but they don't have any cavalry. So we ride out, the witch hunters pick off a few officers, and we melt back into the hills. We start gathering food so we can make it through the winter, and send out more scouts so we find any supply train they might have coming. It's the only way. They didn't expect walls. They'll starve before we do.
The supply train is right here.
Kyla pointed on the map.
It's accompanied by 1,000 horse.
Are you certain? How big is it?
Kyla dropped a sheaf of notes on the table. The men picked up the rice paper sheets and read. Only Logan didn't read as the officers shared the notes back and forth. He stared at Kyla, quizzically, obviously wondering what he was trying to accomplish.
How did you get these, Wolfhound?
The officer used the nickname the soldiers had given Kyla.
I fetched.
Enough. It's worse than we feared.
Worse? It's a disaster.
General, can I have a word with you? Alone?
Logan nodded, and the other men filed from the tent, carrying the notes for further study.
What are you playing at, Kyla?
Just making you look good.
An impending slaughter makes me look good.
A disaster diverted makes you look good.
And you have a plan?
Garawati wants food and a victory. I propose we give them to him.
Why hadn't I thought of that?
It doesn't have to be a victory over us.
Kyla explained. When he finished, Logan didn't look surprised. He looked profoundly sad.
That would make me look good, wouldn't it?
And save thousands of lives, and the city.
Kyla, it's time for us to finish that conversation.
What conversation?
The one about king-making and queen-unmaking.
I don't have any more to say.
Good, then you can listen. People commonly misquote the old Sacronomicon and say that money is the root of all evil, which is moronic if you think about it. The real quote is that the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. Not as pithy, but a lot truer. In the same way, what I am capable of doing in the pursuit of power and sex, the man I choose for Logan Gaia to be will not allow. My hunger for food couldn't make me a monster in my own eyes. Not even when I ate human flesh. I was driven to that by necessity, not perversion. I suppose the same could be said for you, for killing. I saw it on your face when you killed my jailer, Gorky. You do it, but you don't love it. If you loved it, you'd turn into Hugh Gibbet.
There is a foul pleasure in it.
There's pleasure in having a full belly, too. But for some, it's dangerous pleasure. When I ordered you to kill Gorky, you didn't feel that.
Logan saw his tattoo was uncovered and covered it.
I did. I gave an order and he died. I killed with a word and I loved it. And I wanted more.
So now what? You going to become a hermit? Move to a cottage in the woods?
I'm not that selfish. If I asked you, would you kill Tara Grayson?
Absolutely.
If I didn't ask you, would you do it anyway?
Yes.
Have you been planning it?
Yes.
Damn it, Kyla! Now I know!
So why do you ask?
To remove the excuse! Can you rule justly after you take the throne unjustly?
Good question to ask the woman who stole yours.
How, Kyla?
Schedule a meeting with her and drink a lot beforehand.
Damn it, man! How were you going to kill her?
A botched abortion. I'd poison whatever abortifacient she uses. Many of those potions are dangerous. If it appeared she'd taken double what her apothecary recommended, it would look like a tragic and shameful accident for a single, wanton young queen. If the nobles tried to cover up the details, the rumors would swirl around what a whore Tara was, rather than speculations that she was assassinated. And it would make the virtuous new king look even better.
Gods! How long did it take you to come up with that?
Couple of minutes.
It's brilliant, Kyla. It's brilliant. And I forbid it.
You forbid it?
Yes.
And how do you propose to forbid me anything?
Logan looked astonished.
Despite all my efforts, you're not my king. You can't forbid me a damn thing.
Logan's face darkened and all his usual conviviality drained away. It made Kyla conscious of just how tall Logan was. His lean 7-foot height made him a looming, merciless skeleton.
Know this. If I am crowned because of Tara Grayson's murder, I'll have you executed.
You'd kill me for Terra Grayson.
I'd execute you for treason. An attack on Cenaria's sovereign is an attack on Cenaria.
She shouldn't be queen.
But she is.
You had no right to swear fealty.
I did what I had to do to save the people, Kyla. Now I must abide by my word. Politics is ethics writ large.
Politics is the art of the possible, and you know it. On the eve of battle, the tides changed, so you couldn't be king, so you changed course. The tides are changing again.
My word stands.
Can you love an idea more than you love a man and not become a monster? How many friends will you sacrifice on the altar of justice, Logan?
If you force my hand, at least one.
They were standing on a precipice. Socially, Logan had always been Kyler's superior. Morally, Kyler had always felt inferior too. But they'd never been placed in a direct hierarchical relation. Now Logan was giving an order. He would not be moved. Kyler could only accept his order and accept all his orders henceforth, or reject it and them forever. There was part of him that yearned to obey. He was convinced that killing Terra was the right thing, but Logan's moral compass was a more accurate instrument than Kyler's. What was it about submission that was so hard? Kyler wasn't being asked for blind servility. He was being asked to obey a man he knew and loved and respected, who in turn respected him.
The wolfhound is pampered by the fire. The wolf is hunted in the cold. Do you know how much I love you, Logan?
Logan opened his mouth.
This much.
Kyler left the tent. Kyler was back in the city on his way to the one safe house he was confident hadn't been discovered during the God King's reign.
Would you be excited about Logan being king if he told you politics is the art of the possible and asked you to murder his rivals?
I'm already damned. My crimes might as well accomplish something.
So you'll serve clean water out of a filthy cup. You must have better tricks than I do.
The safe house was on the east side, far enough from the fashionable areas that it had been on the city's outskirts. Now, the building was gone. The entrance itself, a flagstone set flush with the ground, was only paces from the God King's new wall. The neighborhood, once fashionable, was buzzing with activity. After the God King's death, thousands of people had fled the Warrens, either hoping to reclaim their lives or hoping to claim someone else's better life. The fires that the displaced had started on their way out of the city had left great swaths of it bare and black. Too few buildings remained to shelter everyone, even without the thousands who had left the city with Terra Grayson. Now, they all were back, and there were no building materials to be found. With an army besieging the city and cold rain starting, people were desperate. Kyler sat with his back to the wall to listen to the tones of the city. There was no way he was going to get into the safe house before nightfall. Even invisible, he couldn't lift a flagstone in the middle of what was now a de facto street without dozens of people noticing. The safe house had another entrance, of course. Unfortunately, a new wall was sitting on it. The gossip was angry. Terra Grayson had stopped the free flow of traffic across the Vanden Bridge this morning, and it had nearly caused a riot. Kyler listened to a proclamation that promised to return to the way things had been before the invasion. The squatters would be driven back into the Warrens, and those legitimate merchants and petty nobility who had been uprooted would be granted their old homes and lands as soon as they could prove their claims. The Herald was greeted with hisses and jeers.
An hour and nine elves am I supposed to prove that I owned a smithy when the Queen burned it and all my deeds to the ground?
I'm not going back. I lived in the Warrens long enough.
I killed six pagans and enough to immortal. I deserve better.
Within an hour, scribes were openly hawking badly forged deeds. An hour after that, a Sakage representative showed up.
Deeds? Who needs a deed? Who wants to be part of the city's finest? Deeds, come one, come all. Bring your money and own a piece of waterfront property.
His deeds were not only higher quality and much more expensive. He said the Sakage guaranteed that no duplicate deeds would be forged. He could only sell deeds for his neighborhood, and he had an allotment of what kind of shops could be represented. Thus, Unless the owner still possessed the original deed, Sakage deeds were as good as gold. Within minutes, the non-Sakage scribes had been chased off or coerced to join. Meanwhile, food prices were skyrocketing. Tough loaves of bread that wouldn't sell for 6 coppers in the morning were selling for 10 after a full day hardening in the sun. As the sun set, people improvised wood frames with cloaks or blankets stretched over them to make lean-tos against the wall. Others wrapped themselves tight in their cloaks, tucked their purses inside their tunics, and slept where they lay, alone or in groups for warmth. Not everyone slept, of course. Darkness brought out the guild rats looking for easy bags. One even bent over Kyler, who hadn't moved in so long she thought him asleep. Kyler waited until the urchin, he couldn't even tell for sure under the grime, but he thought it was a girl, had a hand in his purse. Then he struck.
Oh, please, sir. I was up for a piss, and now I can't find my dar.
Kids who have parents don't say piss when they talk to adults. What guild are you?
Guild, sir?
Kyler clouted her ear.
Black Dragon.
Oh, Black Dragon. That was my old guild. How much are dues these days?
2 coppers.
2? We had to pay 4.
Kyler let her go.
What's your name, kid?
Blue.
Well, Blue, tell the tall kid not to try that fat man's purse. He's not asleep. If you'll get out of here for an hour, I'll leave enough to pay your dues for a week. If you don't, I'll yell that I've caught a thief and tell everyone to watch out for guild rats, and you'll have to move on anyway, and you'll all be lucky to escape a beating.
He let her go, and while she was gathering her crew, he went invisible and lifted the flagstone. Hidden doors set into the ground were never as secure as those set into walls. No matter how expertly constructed, once you opened a door in the ground, you displaced the dirt on the door as well as the dirt that inevitably got packed into the seams. It would be the last time Kyler could use this safe house. The safe house you were afraid to use wasn't a safe house at all. But Kyler needed a noble's clothing, gold, and, thanks to the Kakari, new weapons. Instead of climbing down the ladder, he jumped. Kyler quickly pulled the flagstone shut. He checked his traps, one on the ladder and 2 on the door. All were intact. Then he opened the wood door slowly. The tiny safe house was pristine, if stale. Kyler checked the top of one of the small chests. Across the latch was balanced a piece of his own hair. The hair, of course, wasn't a foolproof indicator of tampering. Even in a sealed safe house, your own entry could disturb the air enough to displace a hair. But if the hair was in place, it was unlikely that anyone else had entered. Kyler shook his head. He wasn't even planning to stay here more than a few minutes, but Durzo's habit of checking traps and examining every corner for threats had sunk deep. And where was Durzo? What had he been doing? Had he simply moved on to another life? Was it so easy for him to leave everything behind? The idea soured Kyler's mood. Durzo was the central figure in Kyler's life, and he'd abandoned him. Durzo had given him the Kakari, a treasure of untold worth, but he hadn't given Kyler his trust or his time. A dusty glass case sat next to the dusty desk. Kyler opened the case. Inside, labeled in Durzo's neat hand, were dozens of jars of herbs, potions, elixirs, and tinctures. Durzo had told Kyler that some wet boys mislabeled their herbs deliberately, so as to confuse or kill anyone who stole from them. Durzo said anyone who had the resources and guts to steal from him could identify an herb or hire someone to do it for him. Kyler suspected the real reason was that Durzo couldn't bear to mislabel anything. That he wouldn't mislabel his supplies, however, didn't mean that Durzo did label all of them. Durzo believed that safe houses had a 1 in 4 chance of being discovered in any given year, so he spread the most valuable items of his collection out among them to minimize losses. Managing such an inventory was probably half the reason Kyler's master had been so paranoid. For in this now worthless safe house, in an unmarked vial smaller than Kyler's thumb, was a substance that looked like liquid gold. It had cost Durzo 1/2 year and as much as a manse on Sidling Way. Its proper name was Philodunamis. Durzo called it
Bottled Fire.
Whereas almost every other tool of the trade was mundane, if rarely known, bottled fire was magic. The only people who could make it were the Harani Aborigines, whose magic was tied to emotion and song.
Soon after being driven from their lowland homes 2 centuries ago, they hadn't had access to the materials they needed to make Philodunamis.
Now, Durzo had known what those were, how he gathered them, and how he had coached a Harani mage into making such a lethal substance. Kyler had no idea. Sitting at the desk, Kyler rooted around until he found the gold-plated tweezers, a wad of cotton, and a candle. Then he couldn't find a tinderbox. Since he could see in the dark, he never carried one anymore. Without a tinderbox, he couldn't light the candle. Without the candle, he couldn't clean the tweezers. Without clean tweezers, he couldn't pull off a wisp of cotton to dip into the bottled fire. Without the cotton, he couldn't test an appropriately tiny measure of the bottled fire.
Damn it!
Why do you make things so hard? Use me, I'm sterile.
Are you telling me there's no little Kokari gravel out there?
Ah ha ha, and I thought Durzo's humor was lacking.
Nonetheless, in a moment, the Kokari puddled in Kyler's palm and formed an instrument with a flexible bulb on one side that tapered down to almost a needle point on the other. Kyler had never seen anything like it before.
Squeeze me and put me in the Philodunamis.
You're amazing.
I know.
Humble, too.
Kyler opened the vial and sucked out a single drop. He dripped it on a rag, closed the vial, and pushed his seat back. The Kokari dissolved back into his skin.
The gold drop of Philodunamis dried in moments, becoming hard and flaky.
Kyler dropped the rag on the ground and dripped some water on it. The water wicked outward until it touched the Philodunamis. The fire consumed the rag instantly and still burned for another 10 seconds, then guttered out.
It's tricky. Water, wine, blood, sweat. Most anything wet should trigger it. But it can get unstable. So by the Night Angels, don't even open it if it's muggy.
Kyler smiled as he tucked the vial away.
Sweat.
He'd pour the bottle on Tara Grayson's incestuous bed, if only such a death were public enough. He collected his clothing and gold and turned to grab a sword from the weapons wall. Then something stopped him.
You bastard.
Hanging on the wall, impossibly, as if Kyler hadn't sold it for a fortune in a city 2 weeks' ride away, was a big, beautiful sword with the word Mercy etched on the blade. There was no explanation, no message of any kind, except for the smirk implicit in resetting Kyler's traps and replacing his single strand of hair. Durzo had redeemed Kyler's birthright. For a second time, Durzo was giving him retribution. Kyler stood in a hazy corridor decorated with brightly colored animals facing a door. There were no sharp edges to anything. It was as if he were looking at the world through sleep-blurry eyes. The door opened without his touch, and as soon as he saw her, his heart lurched. V was lying on a narrow bed. She was the only thing in the world utterly clear, sharp, and present. She raised a hand in supplication, and he went to her. She seemed as unsurprised by his presence as he was. For a moment, he wondered at that. Where was he? How had he come? The thoughts disappeared the moment he touched her hand. This was real. Her hand was small in his, delicate and finely shaped, the skin as calloused as his own. Unlike Aline's, V's third finger was slightly longer than her forefinger. He'd never noticed that before. It was the most natural thing to do, sit on the bed and pull her into his arms. She lay across his lap and clung to him, grasping him convulsively. He held her tight, willing his strength into her. He could feel her need for it. She was confused, lost, scared of this new life, scared of being known, scared of never being known. He didn't have to read her face. He felt it within himself.
She turned tear-swollen eyes to his face, and he looked into her deep green eyes. He was a mirror to her, and he reflected back truth against every fear. The tears slowed and her grip relaxed. She closed her eyes as if the intimacy was too much. She put her hand in his lap, her body finally relaxing. Her long, fiery red hair was unbound, though it was messy and tangled and crimped from where she had worn it in a ponytail all day. He was amazed. It was glossy, silky, mesmerizing, a color that only 1 in 1,000 women had. His eyes followed a strand of her hair past tear-wet eyelashes to a nose with faint freckles he'd never noticed before, to her slender neck. V wore an ill-fitting plain nightdress. It was too short for her, and the knot had come loose, leaving it gaping open. Her nipple was dark pink, small on her full breast, lightly puckered in the room's coolness. The first time Kyler had seen these breasts, she'd exposed herself to shock him. This time, he could feel that she was unaware of it. The unexpected innocence of V's exposure roused something protective in him. He swallowed and moved the cloth to cover her. Despite that V could feel him as clearly as he could feel her, she didn't notice. She was merely that exhausted, or was she so divorced from her body that she didn't attach any significance to her breast being covered? Kyler didn't know, but either way, the wave of compassion he felt overpowered his desire. He barely glanced at her shapely legs, naked to mid-thigh, as he covered them with a blanket. She burrowed into him, so vulnerable and so damn gorgeous he couldn't think straight. He ran his fingers through her hair to call back the more protective feelings. Instead, V melted instantly, yielded completely, a wave of tingles coursing from head to loins. His heart lurched. The only thing he'd ever felt close to this was when he kissed Aline for half an hour and then spooned behind her, tracing her kisses across her ears and neck and skimming his fingertips across her breasts. And it was always then that she stopped him, afraid of losing control completely. V sailed right over that brink. She was his, utterly, completely. He was drunk on her ecstasy. The bond between them burned like fire. He couldn't stop himself. He slowly combed his fingers through her hair, rubbed her scalp, combed his fingers through her hair again. She shifted her hips. V rolled over in his lap so he could reach the other side of her head. He put her facing his stomach, inches from the undeniable evidence of his own arousal. He froze. She felt it, and her eyes flew open. Her pupils were pools of desire.
Please don't stop. I'll take care of you. Promise.
Her casualness threw Kyler. There was a disconnect here in what was supposed to be a connection. It wasn't, let's share this. It was, let's trade. It wasn't love. It was commerce.
I'm sorry. I was being selfish.
She threw back the blanket, and in the illogic of a dream, her ugly nightdress was simply gone. In its place, a fitted red nightgown clung to her curves. She stretched like a cat, displaying herself to marvelous advantage.
You first. It's all yours.
It's all yours. Not, I'm all yours. She was offering herself like a sweetmeat. It was nothing to her. The door opened abruptly and Aline stood there. Her eyes took in V, half-naked, draped over Kyler, her hand on his crotch, and Kyler stupidly enjoying it. Kyler scrambled out of bed.
No!
What? What are you seeing?
Aline, wait!
Kyler woke and found himself alone in the safe house. Dorian was in his chambers with Janine poring over maps of the Freeze and the Verdmeister's estimations of the clan's strength when the Keeper of the Dead entered. Dorian and Janine followed the man into one of the cheerier rooms where a body lay wrapped in sheets. Two huge Highlanders in nondescript southern clothes, but with the bearing of soldiers, stood after making their obeisance.
A Shire vole,
opened the cloth around the corpse's head. The stench was magnified tenfold. The bald head had been split in half, but not cracked. Nothing had been broken or torn. There was simply a slice missing from its crown to its neck. In that instant, Dorian knew not only the victim, but also the killer. Only the black Kakari could make such a cut. Kyler had done this. The rotting sack of meat was Dorian's father, Gareth. His knees felt suddenly weak. Janine came to stand close beside him, but she didn't touch him, didn't take his hand. Any show of comforting him would make him look weak to his men.
How did you do this?
Your Holiness, we thought you'd want His Holiness's body for the pyre. There was a demon in the castle. It did this. The lieutenant went with our 10 best men to kill it. He ordered us to take the body, sire. They were supposed to meet us, but they never came.
How was your journey, really?
The man stared at the floor.
It was real hard, Holiness. We got jumped 3 times. Zakage twice, and some damn traitors in Quarix Pass who went bandit after we lost at Pavel's Grove. They thought we were carrying treasure. Red's not breathing right since I pulled the arrows out.
The man nodded at the other Highlander, who didn't have red hair.
We hoped the Vordmeisters might take a look once you're finished with us, sire.
They weren't bandits. They were rebels.
Dorian stepped forward and put his hand on the Highlander's head. Red tensed, uncertain. He had blood clots and infections all through his lungs. It was amazing he'd lived as long as he had.
This is beyond the Vordmeisters. What about you?
I am fine, Your Holiness.
What happened to your knee?
My horse got killed. Fell on it.
Come here. Kneel.
The men knelt, and Dorian was infuriated at the waste of their bravery. If Dorian weren't such a skilled healer, one would die and the other live a cripple. And for what? To deliver bones. These heroes had made great sacrifices for nothing.
You have served with great honor and courage. In the coming days, I will reward you appropriately.
He healed them both, though it was oddly difficult to use his talent. They looked at Dorian with awe and fear and confusion, as if they couldn't believe that saving their lives was worth the God King's own effort. Dorian dismissed them and turned back to his father.
You sick bastard. You don't deserve a pyre. I should... Keeper, the God King always leaves orders that their bodies be burned so that they may not be used for Krull, yes?
Yes, Your Holiness.
How many times have those orders been obeyed?
2.
You have the bones of every God King for the last 7 centuries, except 2.
16 of your blood were used to raise arcane ghouls and subsequently destroyed. We have the rest. Do you wish me to prepare a substitute corpse for Gareth's pyre, Your Holiness?
Gareth Ursul deserved no less for all the evil he'd done, but refusing his father a decent burial would say more about Dorian than it would about the dead man.
My father was monster enough in life. I'll not make him one in death.
We're not going back, are we?
Janine came before the God King's throne. Dorian waved the guards away. He stood and walked to her, taking her hands in his.
The passes are snowed in.
I mean, we're not ever going back, are we?
She said we. It made him tingle, that unconscious admission of unity. Dorian waved a hand at the gold chains of office he wore.
They would kill me for my father's crimes.
Will you let me go?
Let you?
That hurt.
You're not my prisoner, Janine. You can go whenever you wish. But I have to tell you, I've just received news that Sanariar is under siege. The last warriors to make it through Screaming Winds saw an army surrounding the city.
Who?
Some Kurin general named Garawashi and thousands of Sakurai. It may be that come spring...
We've got to go help them!
Dorian paused, letting her think. Sometimes she did act 16.
I could order my army to attempt the pass, if they were lucky and the weather cooperated and the rebel Highland tribes didn't attack while my army was spread out, we might only lose a few thousand. By the time we got there, the siege would probably be finished, And if we arrived in time and seized the city ourselves, do you think Cenaria would welcome us? The Caladoran saviors? They will not have forgotten what my men did a few months ago. And my soldiers, who lose brothers and fathers and sons in the passage, or who lost friends in the Nocta Hemata, will want the spoils of war. If I forbid rape and murder, they might obey me. But it would plant doubts about me. 200 of my Verdmeisters, there's more than half, have disappeared. I don't yet control the God King's hands, who are the only people who will tell me where those Verdmeisters have gone or who is leading them. Gareth Ursul had other Aethlings I haven't accounted for. I may be facing civil war in the spring, so if it came to it, who do you think the Verdmeisters will follow? Kali, who gives them their power, or the once treasonous Aethling?
The line between her eyebrows was deep with anguish now, helplessness. But Dorian wasn't finished.
And if they do follow me, and we are successful, what will your people say? They've installed a new queen, Terra Grayson.
Terra?
Will the people welcome back young Janine with a Caladoran army? Or will they say you're a puppet, so young that I'm manipulating you? Perhaps without your knowing it. Will Queen Grayson surrender her power?
I thought it was going to be easy after we won. I mean, we won, right?
It was a good question. Perhaps it was the only question that mattered.
We won, but the victory cost us. I can never go south again. All of my friends besides you are in the south. They'll see my reign as a betrayal.
That made him think of Solon. Had Solon even made it out of Screaming Winds alive? The thought made him ache.
If you want to assert your right to Cenaria's throne, I can deliver it. But that would cost you too. The price will be that everyone sees that the God King has given you the throne. Do you think you're ready to rule without help? At 16, do you know how to pick advisors? How to tell when the Chancellor of your exchequer is embezzling? How to deal with generals who see you as a child? Do you have a plan to deal with the Sakage? Do you know why the last two Kurin wars ended and what obligations you have to your neighbors? A plan to deal with Eli Canocht, who occupy your eastern lands? If you don't have all those covered, you'll need help. If you accept help, you'll be seen to be accepting help. If you don't accept help, you'll make mistakes. If you trust the wrong people, you'll be betrayed. If you don't trust the right people, you'll have no one to protect you from your enemies. Assassination has a long history in your kingdom, as slaughter does in mine. Do you have an idea of whom you will marry and when? Do you plan to concede rule to your new husband? Share it or keep it?
I have answers to some of those questions, and I know some people I can trust.
I don't doubt it.
But I hadn't considered all of those. I'm not ready.
I do have an alternative.
His heart pounded. He wanted to use the Vir. In his old life, before the One God found him, he'd learned a glamour to seduce women. Now he could use it just a little, just to help Janine get over her fear and disappointment and to see Dorian as a man. He wouldn't make her do anything she didn't want to do. He quashed the impulse.
No, not that way.
If Janine didn't choose him freely, it was all for nothing.
Stay. Be my queen. I love you, Janine. You are the reason I came to Calador. This throne means nothing to me without you. I do, and will always love you. A queen is what you are, what you are meant to be. And there is work for you here. My fathers haven't had queens. They had chattels, harems, playthings. Calador's people are no worse than any other. But this culture is sick. I thought once that I could run away. I see now that that's not enough. I found my life's work, changing reverence for power to reverence for life. You have no idea what your mere presence will do. Our marriage will redefine marriage for this entire country. That's no small feat, and it will bring no small amount of happiness to the women and the men here.
You want me to marry you because I'll help you in your work?
Janine, lovers always want to make a private world. Just you and me and nothing else matters. The truth is, Everything else does matter. Your family, my family, the different ways we were raised, the obligations we have, the work we do, it all matters. A marriage can be a refuge. But I'd be a fool to ignore what and who I am now, and what and who you are. But the answer is no. I don't want to marry you because I want you to help me. I want you. You're worth more than all the rest of it combined. I'd rather serve in a hut with you than rule all the world without you.
You honor me, my lord.
I love you.
You are a good man, Dorian Ursul, and a great man. May I think about it for a few days?
Of course.
His heart died a little. Let me think about it. Isn't the answer a man wants to his proposal? Of course, most men managed a little romance before asking. In one way, he was horribly disappointed in himself. In another, he was content. He wanted Janine's mind to consent to this match, not just her heart. Romantic feelings would come and go. He didn't want her to choose in haste and regret at leisure. She excused herself, and the guards let in Dorian's next appointment. It was Hopper. The man limped in quickly and prostrated himself. Janine hesitated halfway out the door. She had told Dorian that there was something about Hopper that she wanted to share with him, but they hadn't gotten around to it.
Your Holiness, the women have been in an uproar. They beg me to ask if you'll be accepting any of them into your harem.
Janine turned away, as if embarrassed to be eavesdropping. But she didn't hasten to leave, either.
Of course not. Not one of them.
Tara Grayson had moved the coronation up. No matter that an army was encamped around the city, and that with her scant supplies already dwindling, it was wildly inappropriate to have a party, Tara had decided she couldn't wait 2 months. Her coronation would be in 3 days, so Mama Kay had to come to the castle to meet the new court bard. He squinted and looked about as pleased as Mama Kay expected. She'd commissioned a piece from him on their last meeting for the Queen's birthday. She hadn't mentioned the coronation was the same day. In retaliation, he'd gotten himself hired as the new court bard, meaning she was paying for a piece he'd have to compose anyway.
Do you know who I am, Quogley Mars?
Mama Kay stepped past him into his small apartment. Quogley's sense of smell was as good as his eyesight was bad. Her spies said he'd even spent time with Alatera's royal perfumer.
You are Madame Kyrena, a woman of great power and wealth.
It was a pity nothing else about the man was as beautiful as his voice. Quogley Mars resembled nothing so much as a squashed frog. He had a wide, fleshy mouth that turned down at the edges, no neck, a perpetual squint, and a small, round gut like a ball. Rather than trousers, he wore baggy yellow tights on his skinny legs, and he had a tiny tricorn hat with a feather in it. He was one of the ugliest men Mama Kay had ever seen, save for a few lepers far gone in their disease.
I heard your new tale, The Fall of the House of Gunda. It was fearless, beautiful. You should write more.
Quogley bowed, accepting the praise as his due.
I usually prefer the honesty of instrumentals. The pipe and lyre never lie, nor by their tones do good men die.
An odd sentiment from a minstrel who's been chased from half the capitals of Midkiru because he can't stop himself from telling the truth.
Which was why she'd asked if he knew who she was. At least he was capable of discretion. She smiled.
May I ask why you're here?
Damn all artists. Their bribes had to come as introductions to the influential in gifts of clothing or instruments, in arranging special concerts and making sure they were well received. Of course, a bard rarely minded when some beautiful young music aficionado offered to polish his flute either. But it all had to be discreet. The only punishment they could think to face for Mama Kay's displeasure was indifference. Years ago, Mama Kay had sent a gorgeous little flute case to a newly popular bard called Rowan the Red. The girl had given him some grossly ignorant compliment, which she wouldn't have if she were the educated young noblewoman she was pretending to be. Instead of taking her to his room and giving her better things to do with her mouth, Rowan had quizzed her and publicly made her look a fool. It didn't take him long to guess who might have sent her. When Mama Kay's most gifted wet boy, Durzo Blint, had arrived a few hours later, The bard was already writing a song mocking her and making wild allegations, some of them true. No one ever heard that catchy tune, or any other tune from Rowan the Red, but it had been a near thing, and since then Mama Kay avoided bards when she could. But bards were too good a resource to abandon. They plied Mama Kay with every tidbit they knew, and they lapped up every morsel she dropped. Indeed, they often gave her new information, for bards were always present at parties, even if her other spies were not. But Quogley was different. Quogley's stories were rare, and the nobles regarded them as absolute truth. Other bards often repeated them. He was hard to interest, but once that interest was piqued, he was a bulldog.
Do you know who I am, Quogley Mars?
You're the owner of half the brothels in the city. You're a woman who crawled out of the gutter to climb higher than anyone would have believed. My guess is you're the Sakage Mistress of Pleasures.
One of my girls has a small talent of foretelling. She doesn't dream often, but when she does, she's never been wrong. 2 years ago, she dreamed of you, Maestro, though she'd never seen or heard of you, and indeed, you hadn't yet come to Sonaria. She described you perfectly. She said a song burst from your mouth like a river. The river was the purest, clearest water she'd ever seen. She said I tried to stop it, but the waters overwhelmed me, and I drowned. The next night she dreamed the same dream, but this time I tried to strike you down before you could sing. But the song was unstoppable, and again I drowned. On the third night, I swam. I think the name of your river is Truth, Quogley Mars. So I ask again, do you know who I am?
You're the Shinga of the Sakage.
Though she'd been prepared for it, hearing the truth spoken aloud frightened her. But this was why she'd hired Quogley Mars in the first place. She'd paid him for a flute piece, then had her informants drop hints to him of a much bigger story, the kind of tale Quogley couldn't resist telling. But the man was incredibly bright, and that made him dangerous.
How'd you learn?
Everyone knew you were Jarl's right hand. When he disappeared, none of the Sakage's work was interrupted. Agon's dogs continued training, the Nocta Hemata happened, and there was no rush of thugs' bodies floating in the plith. The Sakage isn't an organization to put off a struggle for succession just because there's a war. You've been Shinga for more than a month, haven't you?
15 years. Always behind puppet Shingas. Shingas don't tend to die of natural causes.
So what are you buying? I'm guessing you want more than a flute piece.
I want you to sing a song of Terra Grayson's secrets.
Do you know what those are?
Yes.
Are you going to tell me?
No.
Why not?
Because I've made my living telling lies, and you know it. Because the truth is damning enough. Because you're renowned for winking out the truth on your own.
So, if you can't dam the river, you wish to channel it. How do you propose to buy me off?
You want more than coin?
Oh, yes.
Then I'll give you what you wish.
I want your story. You will answer every question I ask, and if you lie in any particular, I will use your tale to cast you in a devastating light.
Now you tempt me to take my chances with prophecy, and signal the wet boy I have waiting behind that curtain to kill you. A whore's truth has too many sharp edges. I will tell my story and not spare myself, but I will not share the secrets of the men I could destroy with what I know. It would be my death, and some few of them deserve better. I will give you more of my story, and more about the Sakage than you could ever learn alone, but that is all, and you will not tell it for at least a year. I have work to do first.
Quogley's skin had turned green, making the impression of a frog complete.
You don't really have a wet boy behind that curtain, do you?
Of course not. Do we have a deal?
If you tell me why you're doing this, I don't believe it's because of some whore's dream.
If Logan Gaia were king, Jarl's dream of a new Sonaria might come to pass. Things wouldn't have to be how they were for my sister and me growing up. or how they are for the guild rats now.
Sounds awfully altruistic.
I have a daughter.
Now that I didn't know.
I'm the richest, most powerful person in this country, Maestro. But Ashinga's power dies with her, and my wealth will be taken by whoever finally murders me. Having a daughter has cost me the man I love, and quite nearly my life. But as much as she endangers me, I endanger her much more. I need Logan Gaia to become king, because that's the only way I can go legitimate. And going legitimate is the only way I can pass anything on to my daughter, except death.
You don't just mean to be a merchant, or even a merchant queen, do you? You mean to establish a new noble house. How would you buy such a thing?
That's a tale I'll tell after the coronation. Do we have a deal?
You want me to learn a queen's darkest secrets and make a song of it in 3 days? That's ridiculous! Impossible! There isn't a bard in Mikiru who could do such a thing. But I am no mere bard. I am a genius. I'll do it.
Sing fearlessly, Maestro. I will make sure your song isn't interrupted.
That's it. Head notes of bergamot and galbanum, with a third I can't recall. And the heart notes are jasmine and daffodil over bass notes of vanilla, iris, amber, and forest. Nwek Vin Bromar, the royal Alatarian perfumer himself, showed me that perfume. He said it was his queen's own perfume. No one else ever.
Mama Kay smiled, glad the gesture hadn't been wasted.
May I just say, Madam Kyrena, you frighten and intrigue me in almost equal measures.
I promise you, Maestro, the feeling is mutual.
Scarred Rabel was on time. He always was. This time, their meeting was in the castle's statue gardens. Scarred Rabel wore the 100-colored robe of a hecatonarch, the long sleeves covering his ritually scarred arms and hands, the chasuble covering the lattice of scars across his chest and neck. He smirked at her.
Yes, my child. Do you have sins to confess, or sins to contract?
Tara Grayson favored him with a contemptuous stare.
You blaspheme, coming as a priest.
Out of 100 gods, there's got to be one with a sense of humor. What's the job, Your Highness? People see you talking to me too long, they might think you really are confessing. They might wonder why.
I want you to kill Logan Gaia. Sooner is better.
Tara hitched her bandaged arm. It was healing from where that damned shadow had stabbed her. But slowly.
Yeah, right.
I'll pay you twice what I paid you to kill Durzo Blint.
It's funny how you didn't tell me I was killing Blint until afterward.
It turned out all right, didn't it?
Only because I caught him unawares.
I thought you said you fought him man to man.
I did, but it was a near thing. And you didn't pay me half enough.
Oh, so that's it. Bargaining. How tiresome. Name your price, assassin.
I'm a wet boy, as you should damn well know. I killed Durzo Blint. As to bargaining, this ain't bargaining.
How much?
Damn it. She'd worn high, thick sleeves to conceal the bandage on her arm, but it hurt. And she didn't dare touch it, not in front of Rabel, who'd tell the Sakage.
It would be a hell of a job, wouldn't it? They say Duke Gaia killed an ogre 50 feet tall at Povel's Grove. They say he's served by a madman with filed teeth who's ripped men clean in half. And a 2-legged wolfhound and 1,000 sword whores. I even heard tell of a demon that came looking to save Logan back during the coup. Well, that's a fearful lot of fearful friends that man has. And a fearful lot of fearful enemies a wet boy could make by killing him.
I'll give you 10 times the usual, and I'll make you a baronet with lands.
It was a princely sum, and she could tell Scarred Rabel was stunned at the amount.
Tempting? But nah. The only wet boy who'd take this job would be Hugh Gibbet.
Then send him to me.
Can't. He's feeding the fish for taking jobs Mother Sagage didn't approve. And Mother Sagage has told all her little chicks, no jobs on Gaia.
What? Don't you know who I am?
I will tell the Nine you tried.
Fury washed Terra to her souls.
If the Sakage stands against me, so help me, I will destroy you all.
By the High King's beard, woman, we said no to one job. There's a big difference between turning down a job and being your enemy.
You will do this, or I will stamp you out.
That is a damn fool thing to say to a wet boy. But then you're a damn fool woman all round, aren't you? Do you have any idea what Logan is doing this morning? No? While you're here trying to murder your allies, Logan is saving his.
What are you talking about?
The Nine says that you have a week to take back your threats against them. And to give you a hint of what kind of war you'd be starting, they've arranged for a small diplomatic disaster this morning. They ask that you keep in mind that future disasters need neither be small nor diplomatic.
How did you know?
We know everything.
Solon, why does my mother hate you?
Solon sat up, brushing filthy straw from his hair.
What has she done?
It was early morning and chilly, and Katie wore a purple samite wrap over her shoulders. Solon was relieved he wouldn't have to spend the interview trying not to gape at her breast like a mainlander. Relieved and disappointed.
Do you know why or not?
Standing, Solon walked to the bars.
It will not be easy to tell or hear.
Humor me.
After I completed my training with the Blue Mages 12 years ago, I came home, you remember? I was 19. I asked my father for permission to seek your hand. He told me your family would never consent.
My mother never stopped at anything to advance my family. That's why I never understood her hating you. She should have been pushing me to marry a prince.
Your mother feared that you were my sister.
In rapid succession, emotions flitted over Katie's face. Bewilderment, incredulity, understanding, surprise, revulsion, incredulity again.
Katie, I don't wish to slander either of our parents. The liaison was brief, only as long as my mother's last ill-fated pregnancy. When she and the baby both died, my father took it to be the God's judgment on him. But then your mother was pregnant. Years later, when my father noticed my interest in you, he requested a green mage come to tell him whether you were his daughter. In return for determining your patrimony and keeping their silence, I was to take my schooling with the green mages. Neither they nor my father expected me to show any talent. They merely hoped to have a Sethi prince as a friend. As it turned out, I wasn't that talented at healing. Regardless, they told my father that you were definitely not my sister, but your mother never trusted Magi. Her fears told her that you looked more like my father than yours.
How do I know any of this is true?
I wouldn't lie about my father. He was a great man. It wounded me when he told me he'd been faithless to my mother. It wounded him, too. He was different after she died. Can you think of anything else that makes sense of your mother's actions? Why don't you ask her?
Why didn't you come back?
I was 19 when I learned. You were barely 16. I tried to reassure your mother that the mages were telling the truth. She thought I was threatening her. You were young, and I didn't want to poison you against her by telling you. I had an offer for more training at Shokendi, so I took it. I wrote to you every week, and when you never responded, I sent a friend to deliver a letter personally. He was thrown out of your family's estate and told you were betrothed and you never wanted to hear from me again.
I was never betrothed.
Which I didn't find out until later. I was going to come home then, but a prophet told me I had two paths before me. Storm riving, storm riding, by your word, or silence. A brother king lies dead. If I came home, I would kill my brother. If, on the other hand, I went to Sonoria, I might save the South from Kalador.
So, did you?
What?
Did you save the world?
No. I hid that I was a mage from a man who was like a brother to me. A man who would have become king. When he found out, he dismissed me. The next day, he was killed by an assassin I could have stopped if I had been there.
So you come home like a whipped dog looking for scraps?
I came home to make things right. I have no idea what happened here. No Sethi on the mainland will talk about it.
You took the wrong fork of the prophecy. You should have killed him.
What?
She pulled the samite wrap tight and looked out Solon's window.
Your brother was a horror. He squandered all the goodwill the people felt for your family within a year. His invasion of Ladesh cost us 3 of our 4 fleets, and the Ladeshian counterstroke cost us the last of our colonies. He forced my brother Jairus to lead a hopeless attack, and when it failed, he threw him in the dungeon, where he was strangled. Sejuran claimed Jairus hanged himself. He forced the great families to sponsor week-long parties that they had no way of paying for. He raised taxes on rich and poor alike, but gave dispensations to his friends. He built a menagerie that housed over 1,000 animals, while people begged at the gates. He ordered silk beds made for his lions, and soon began throwing those who displeased him to those beasts. He liked to train with the military, but would order men killed for not really trying when they sparred with him, or for daring to bruise the imperial flesh when they did try. He took to carrying knuckle bones, which he made anyone he encountered roll. The sides range from winning a purse of gold to death. I came across him one day and he made me roll, though usually the high families were exempt. I won. He made me roll again. I won 4 more times until he had no more money. He was furious, so he ordered his retainers to pay me. I realized that he was going to make me roll until I rolled my death. So I challenged him to one last roll. I said, let 3 sides be death and the other 3 be marriage. My audacity intrigued him. He said that if I was going to beggar him, I might as well be his wife. Sejuran was quite the wit. He only gave me 2 of the 6 sides. I won. He kept his word and threw a huge wedding party at my family's expense. After he fell asleep, I cut his throat. I walked back to the great hall in my bare feet and my shift, my arms covered in blood to the elbows. The party was still going. It was barely midnight, and those parties always had a curious frenzy. Everyone knew they might die at the king's least whim. Everything stopped when I walked in. I sat in the king's seat and told them what I'd done. They cheered, Solon. Someone pulled his body into the great hall, and the gentle nobles of this empire ripped him apart with their bare hands. I've been undoing the damage he inflicted on this kingdom ever since. In 9 years, I haven't been able to fix half of what he destroyed in 3.
And you never married?
Never remarried.
Oh.
I've been too busy. Besides, they call me the Black Widow. Those who hate me, I don't mind. It's good that they fear me. For all that, I'm 100 times the monarch your brother was. I made missteps early and alienated some who might have been friends. I have learned since. But some men will never forgive a slight. My hold on this throne is a daily struggle, one that you could easily upset.
I have no desire for a crown. I will swear that in front of all the court.
Then what is it you want, Solon?
Just you.
There is no just me. I'm queen. But look at my face, and you will see the holes where my clan rings were. Your cheek has never been pierced. Do you think that doesn't matter? If I am queen, what would you be?
Is a queen not a woman?
Not first.
Is there any room beneath that crown for love?
I loved you once, Solon. When you left again, I was devastated. People prayed for your return, hoping you could restrain your brother, or later hoping you'd replace him. I prayed for your return too, for other reasons. But you never came. I prayed even on the night of my wedding that you would come set things right. I prayed as your brother pulled me to his bed that you would burst through the doors. You didn't. Besides, I married your brother.
But you said you...
Afterward. I meant to get him so drunk that he'd pass out, but for once, he wasn't in the mood to drink, and I was too frightened. I waited until it was over, and he was asleep. Even after what he'd just done, I was barely able to cut his throat. In his sleep, he looked so much like you.
I'm so sorry.
Don't you dare pity me. Don't you dare.
It's not pity. It's love, Katie. I hurt you, and I allowed you to be hurt. And I'm sorry.
In 2 days, I marry Oshobi Takeda.
You don't love him.
Don't be stupid.
Katie, give me a chance. I'll do anything.
You can watch the festivities from your cell. Goodbye, Solon.